a short dialogue with between the speakers, and then we're going to be open to the floor. So I would think that we could have about 10 to 15 minutes for a dialogue, and then we can go back to the floor. Okay, so Basileos and Lawrence, we have escaped from Plato's cave, I hear. Escaped from Plato's cave. Okay, well, have you any questions that you would like to ask Lawrence?
Enjoy the talk is an understatement, because it made me think new things, and it really regenerated a lot of dormant ideas in our minds. And one of them, the most important thing is the what you say, that the steerer and the steer, in how to build an objective or verifiable or scientific picture with conscious entities and that have an inner kind of volition. I think this is the challenge of the next remaining of our century. And it's a cross-disciplinary thing, how to decide what is a in a complex system, what is a steerer and who is a steer? Are there the boundary conditions? Are there the initial conditions? What determines where things will go? Could we still be open for intervention on the evolution of a system by their own dynamics? So these are for me, is it, as a philosopher, would you be able in the coming years to give us a kind of roadmap of this new science, how to include the steerer? The not only the steered, but the steerer in a description of a new kind of science. So your task as a philosopher is to guide and to shape this kind of new kind of science methodologically and epistemologically.
Help. Help. Basileos and I had a conversation yesterday afternoon that ended up in fisticuffs. So, I wish I'm looking for help here. I guess I. Could you? Did you have any thoughts on this? Peter?
I certainly have a lot of thoughts on it, yes. Whether I can give you a roadmap for the future or not, that's quite different. But what has been raised now is this whole question of self-consciousness and whether self-consciousness and consciousness are the same. And I don't know the answer to that one. The question which I asked Bernard was whether, in fact, when all the quantum physicists shut their doors, does quantum physics cease to exist? And this is a really interesting question, because it goes right into levels of consciousness. And if the level of consciousness changes, then the perceived universe changes. And as you all know, in transcendent states, time doesn't exist, space doesn't exist as we know it. And if one had a physics which arose from that level of consciousness, would it be quite different? And in essence, when you're starting to talk about a roadmap, Basileos, you're coming right down to these sort of fundamental questions. Mm-hmm. And? Can you take us further on that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I can only talk by habit. And the thing is, would be the research. I mean, try and like living beings sense their environment and they try things that they might work, they might not work. I don't think, I mean, that's my personal biased thing that we have to be somehow open and foster research on this kind of questions. I mean, many people will say that it's enough if I look at my own consciousness by meditation or by a practice, contemplation, whatever. I mean, Christian or Buddhist, that doesn't really matter. But this also is elusive. I mean, if you try to pin down, as you say, one thing is consciousness and the other thing is self-consciousness.
Absolutely.
Once you try to pin down your self-consciousness, is elusive and it drives you to other places and in meditation and all that. But this does not necessarily translate to a way to understand the world. It transforms you, everything. But then how do I distinguish a conscious of a non-conscious being other than my own consciousness? Because for that I'm sure, okay, say I'm self-conscious. and I don't need anybody's testimony for that, right?
Yes.
But how do we cross and communicate?
Here we come on to the whole literature of automata and what an automaton consists of. And then, of course, you go back to the Turing question. Can you tell an automaton when you see it? Yes.
Without a microphone, I'm going to have to speak. Like,
No, you don't have to.
Is that the one? Like an automata?
Now I can tone down.
Okay. I'm afraid I find the term steerer and steered a little bit offensive because it smacks of Cartesian duality of the ghost and the machine and the spirit. And this is what has got science into trouble in the first place, was Mr. Descartes. And ever since then, the scientists have been saying, okay, we're going to have to get rid of the ghost because we can't really see the two of them working. Now, they've gone their merry way in one direction, but I think that we just have to be careful of these steerer and steered ideas, because I think it's my gut feeling is that it's an illusion, and I would be very interested in whether the speakers could address themselves to this whole dualistic heresy. Whether they could address that dualistic heresy. Thank you.
Basilius, are you going to address yourself to this heresy?
As a heretic or as an Orthodox?
No, it's a real question. It's a fundamental question. You see, we've been talking about whether or not we've escaped from Plato's cave. That's fine. But in fact, was there a cave in there in the first place? And so this is the question which we're struggling with now. Steered or the steerer? We don't actually know. And when we're talking about consciousness being a fundamental property of the universe, then exactly should we divide it up in that way, or will it manifest as it manifests? And then you come back to the whole question of plans again. So, what's your view?
I don't have any problems with Cartesian or non-Cartesian. I mean, it's a matter of vocabulary and the frame. If we accept the duality of steerer, steered, we should be conscious of what we are accepting. Yeah. It's not that dangerous, the duality itself.
Into the mic.
What is really dangerous is being trapped by that and not being able to go back and reconsider. So I wouldn't feel threatened to accept any heresy, but I wouldn't like to have this dominating and becoming an orthodoxy. So everything has to be considered and reevaluated with what it gives. It's quoting. So we should, I mean, as a matter of speaking, let's accept this duality. Or as a matter of speaking, let's accept Cartesian duality. A great question that you are raising, I think, is can you have a scientific approach to things without the Cartesian duality? That's to be seen. For the moment,
this is where we are in consciousness
research.
If I can
just respond to that, I think that there might be a misapprehension here in terms of in terms of the effectiveness of the use of that distinction between steer and steered. All that's meant there is that in the first three eras, the radiation, matter and the life eras, there was no need to distinguish between, in terms of cause and effect, between the modality of the cause and the modality of the effect. They were both the cause was a result of unconscious evolutionary processes. So there was no steering going on. The steering that was going on was unconscious steering, just Darwinian evolution is an example of just unconscious steering. The need for making a distinction between steerer and steered is a way of resolving the fact that at some point in cosmic history, rather recently, some events began happening that couldn't be explained by this unconscious, if you want to call it unconscious steering. Now you have a whole new modality of causality, and that means that the differences between an unconscious universe, which incidentally, I mean, the modern physics needs a sort of a universe sidecar to house the physicists who talk about this unconscious universe, because they're talking about it is certainly not unconscious. So you need just in terms of configuration space for speaking, you need to draw a distinction between a totally steered universe and a universe which is beginning to be steered purposefully. And if you don't like the word steered, then I'm sure we can find substitutes that maybe don't have that kind of jarring mechanistic sound. You see wheels steering. So I mean, maybe we're talking at cross purposes here to be disappointed to hear a distinction being made between conscious and unconscious evolution. And something that maybe I'm not following that you
fishing for possibly is the fact that you have an approach which is dualistic, which started with Descartes and which to some extent is still very much alive in most of the world religions. And you've got what you might call a non-dualistic or monistic view, which is a tradition which comes through Goethe and his view, where there isn't this separation between spirit and matter, and where it's more of a continuum, actually, and where the whole geometry of matter is seen in a very different way from the way that Newton and his descendants viewed it, you see. And then in that view, there is no need for the steerer and the steered. The observer is the observed, and you have basically a single unified view. It's different.
Thanks. I think that puts it very nicely. You can come back to that in a moment. Marilyn, I know you want to speak, and then Una.
I want to say something as a reductionist scientist and then something as a mystic. In terms of the general discussion, I mean, in terms of whether there's some sort of collective purpose of intelligence, you know, purpose is a very, very difficult term and none of us can really get to grips with it. But you really can't ignore mutation and selection over millions of years. And if you read Sean Carroll's book, Endless Forms, Most Beautiful, he describes very beautifully how that works. So lots of genes have duplicated, and over millions of years, things that work better for an animal's survival work, and they get selected for. For instance, the eye has developed three times. If an animal can see, this is a great survival advantage. And when you look back, oh, it's developed this eye so it can see, it looks like a purpose, but it was mutation selection over millions of years. And we really have to acknowledge that. The second thing is about the science of interconnectedness. The problem with interconnectedness is that it doesn't exist. But what is between things is far more important than the things themselves. If you take something like love, which is an example I often give, and I say, well, what's it made of? What color is it? You know, what's the shape of it? And so on. We know that love's very important. It works. Things flourish and survive. And yet it's between things. It's the same as seeing. I see with my visual cortex. Do I see with my visual cortex? Or do I see over there? Is my conscious over there? It's because I'm looking at Vasilius. No, it's in between. It requires my visual cortex and it requires him being there. The same with my consciousness. My awareness in my brain. If I didn't have a brain, I wouldn't be aware of anything. And total awareness is a sort of a consciousness. Mainly my consciousness is anchored to bodily concerns, but it can go out there and be liberated. So where the consciousness requires my brain, it requires things to be conscious of. And interconnectedness, there's nothing that what's between things that continues to evolve and create, you know, light coming in and out of form and space, existence, happening all the time. It's happening between, and there's no space, no time, there's no thing, there's no substance between. But interconnectedness, I can tell you, as a science, normally we'd have one variable and everything else constant. Like you take a wheel off a car and you know that the wheel's required for it to roll. And one can do that with different functions, the 3,000 functions controlled by genes in the metabolome. You can knock one out and see what happens, keeping everything else the same. But now science is heading towards where we can look at every single gene as whether it's being expressed or not expressed. And we can look at them being turned off and on as we shift the suspension structure of the interconnected 3,000 enzyme metabolome. We can shift it over there if you put something in, shift it over there if you take something out. So this science of interconnectedness is now being addressed by so-called reductionist scientists. And it's terribly, terribly complicated. But the encouraging thing is, in interconnected systems, whether they be the government or a metabolome, there are certain key players. And they're going to tell you, like, you might have 10 key players of the 3,000 biochemical reactions in the metabolome. And those 10 key players, like the government whips, can tell you which way things are going. So things are happening in terms of looking at more and more variable components in science. Thank you.
Can I just have a tiny comment about the scientists here, okay? Because I admire the person who got three personalities, both scientist, mystic, and poet. But to a reductionist scientist, I personally believe that when you look at all the millions of years of development of the genes, that it's not just random selection, which I understand, I think, quite well, but there is also purpose in this, because every animal, every bacteria want to live, so she's got a purpose, which science today still don't recognize. The purpose, not just in human being, but in every bird that you want to find the best partner for here to have the best children. So we can see there is a purpose in every animal, and its purpose in this is, for me, reflects that its purpose in the universe.
You're just reading survival backwards.
Okay, Una.
So we all listen with a different purpose, to pick up Tuvi's point. And I thought today's two presentations for me are the very best of the network and why I joined. Because I listen from the purpose of my world, which is how do we organize our businesses to be really successful in serving the needs of humanity? And so listening to you, I'm listening and seeing how this relates to the complex organizations, global businesses with which I work, and how can we learn from all the fantastic work you're doing and have done to think about this stuff, which I don't have time to do, but I can apply it. So how I apply it. So I thought just to take a couple of things. Vasily, you talked about that nice slide where you had the structure, the simple organization that is so ordered, which was the world of business in the old days when we just made widgets. And the world we're in today, where we've realized, well, many of our businesses now, we're not making widgets. We're like Facebook, we're creating a business out of friendships. And that's a networked world. Mm. We're discovering a world where our organizations are increasingly a self-organized network of people. Actually, professional partnerships have always worked that way, and thankfully that's where I've been working. So when we had, you know, at Linklaters, 500 partners globally, how do you get them all to work together in a harmonious way? Because you can't have a structure. They don't want a steerer, certainly, and they don't want to be steered. But there is a collective consciousness. And each different law firm I would go to has a different collective consciousness that enables each of them to be successful in different ways. So there's a lot I think we can learn from complexity theory about how to make the best of these organizations. And there is a huge evolution occurring in many, many businesses. So this question that you came to, Lawrence, about the consciousness of human beings and steering the world. Of course, that is a big problem we've got with business. It's been manipulating the world, drawing on the taking away from the collective commons of earth, air, fire, water. We know we're using all of that's free at our own expense and not necessarily for the benefit of the planet. But what's good and what's really happening that's exciting me is now we have more chief executives and more organizations who are asking why. This deeper question, and you take someone like Paul Polman leading Unilever, now there is a deep purpose of why are we here and how can we actually be responsible and conscious of every single aspect of our relationship with the environment, with human beings, with society, with the way we organize ourselves as a business and relate to it. So I just wanted to thank you very, very much for both of your really clear presentations. And if you know anyone who's got my interest and is relating and thinking about this area, I'd really love to know more, because we've got a huge amount of work to do in the business world and we have a lot to learn from both of you.
Thank you.
Once again, I'm straying on Bernard's area slightly, but I know he knows a lot more about than I, so you must tell me if my question is completely meaningless. But I'm wondering if in worrying about the emergence of consciousness now and wondering about how there can be consciousness in the rest of the Ouroboros for the previous 13 million years, we've missed John Wheeler's idea about the participatory anthropic principle, where by observing something, by bringing it into consciousness, if you like, we affect it, we bring it into manifestation in a sense. And John Wheeler, I think, spoke of what is true of the here and now, because we're looking out at far galaxies and seeing them as they were 10 billion years ago, is also true of the far and long ago. So are we, in a sense, bringing the universe into consciousness, not only now, but throughout time?
Nice question. Do you want to answer that, Basilius?
I mean, not really answer, but let me draw on this book I was reading about Inside the Cosmic Mind. So there's at a certain instant, there's a comment about how Pauli was one of the founders of quantum mechanics, and he had severe psychological problems that Carl Jung, was helping him address. And at a certain moment, Pauli was describing the quantum entities, the fundamental building blocks of the universe, to Jung as having a mind of their own. And they dance around and they go and they collect and they recollect. Jung saw on that his idea of the subconscious mind and the role of archetypes in forming things and emerging from the soup of primordial soup. The archetypes are still terra incognita in science. We are trying to understand what they are, but I don't think that there are many people who would take it seriously scientifically because of their Cartesian prejudice and superstition. Now, in the end, I mentioned a guy named Diedrich Arts, and he has done the opposite. He is a quantum mechanical guy who has devoted his life in quantum mechanics from top up, and then he realized that our mind, I mean, the only proven conscious entity that we are all agrees is human beings, right? I mean, so he made precise experiments with human beings and how they perceive things, and he saw the other end of the Ouroboros. Now it's not that little particles dance as if they had a mind of their own. It's that our minds are dancing as if they are a swarm of particles with dancing on their own. So I think that this is a fascinating era to connect the dots, so to speak, and realize where consciousness emerges from. It might be also important for organizations, because there you have a collective consciousness that have to emerge and influence our own lives in a large scale. And I think that you will be seeing more and more titles of books, articles, seminars about complexity in organizations. After Ostrom got her Nobel 2009, it was just after 2008, because when Lehman Brothers fell, they realized, oops, we got something fundamentally wrong here. I think that the more we're intertwined with this crisis and the more we don't know what we're doing, people will start thinking, let's see things in a different perspective. So you will be hearing more and more about complexity in organizations.
Right, we have two more. We have Peter first, then Eddie, then you. And if you keep them short, we'll have time for them all. But if you make long questions and long answers, then I guess so many.
Yeah, a few comments about the word consciousness. I know Peter said that when he was training to be a psychiatrist, the word consciousness was not used at all. The word awareness was used, but the word consciousness wasn't. So that's quite amazing in psychiatry not all that long ago. Now, when I was about 17, I remember reading a book about the Indian philosophy, and it mentioned their cosmic consciousness. Well, I didn't really understand what the term meant. Now, about 21 years ago, when I started at King's College to do a doctorate, my supervisor said he wanted me to do it on consciousness studies. So when I started mentioning to people in the department I was going to write a thesis on consciousness, they all just ridiculed. So I was told to say, tell everybody that you're writing a doctorate on cognitive machines. I was a little bit lucky. A few months later, there was the well-known Professor John Taylor, who was working on neural networks. So as he started using the word, I did. Now, it's really quite extraordinary that during the last 20 years to see how the word has actually changed and been used. Because when I wrote my dissertation, I soon realised that the word had completely different meanings to people in different disciplines, from the neurologists and from the anthropologists and so on and so on. They used it in an entirely different way. The word now is used to describe, shall we say, some overall intelligence that was responsible for creating the universe. It seems that the word is now used in that particular way. Peter, you just drew the distinction between self-conscious and consciousness. So I think the word has actually been taken in view of the limit, perhaps the limitation of our language. Perhaps we need, as has already been said, a much more refined language to identify different characteristics. Hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much. Eddie?
Vasilios, I was absolutely delighted to hear you mention Pauli, because and the work Pauli did with Jung and astrology was one of the topics. Now, you'd be interested to know that a very good friend of mine, Ray Walder, he has developed Pauli's ideas, and Pauli put forward a rudimentary idea about the structure of experience. Mm-hmm. Now, the whole of our subjective nature, we just call it unconscious subjective, but according to this, it has a structure and it has a dynamic. Now, this scientist, Ray Walder, very great scientist, but unknown, therefore not famous, he is completely mathematically, and I've got his book and I'll show it to you tomorrow, he has taken Pauli's ideas using complex number theory, and entirely theoretically he has developed, or he has found, the value of the fine structure constant, the weak and strong forces in the atom, human birth, and a lot of fundamental constants that have been experimentally derived using entirely theoretical principles to about 4 or 5 decimal places. Mm. So this is the work of Pauli, which has tremendous potential. Mm.
Thank you. Yeah,
that's I'll show it to you tomorrow. But this is a very good example of what great scientists can do.
Eddie? Okay, thank you for that, Eddie. Okay, last question.
Well, it's Roderick done it. Yes, sir. Well, I put two things together. Lawrence defined the science revolution from 1600 as being corpuscles with forces between them. But that is perhaps to make things more concrete than was even thought at the time. And in fact, it's only later that the forces have been taken for granted, but the existence of those forces itself was a complete puzzle to those who postulated those forces. And particles, too, sort of, whereas particles, on the other hand, fade away, that now is it not rather an arbitrary concept? What is a particle at one level is actually a vast empty space with two subparticles, namely, for instance, the neutron and the electron. So whether something's a particle or is part of a system depends on your point of view. So it's not surprising that we've moved beyond it. Now we have a bigger perspective. And so the interconnectedness may be the reality, because as Marilyn said, that actually it's a question of your point of view. It's a question of what you want to derive from your point of view and what you're seeking. And there are many alternative and equally valid systems. Put that as a question or as a comment. I'm not sure.
Do you like to say something?
Yeah, that was interesting comment. I think one of my sense that there's a variety of puzzle forms in our group here. We have different puzzle forms, and so each one requires its own not only answers but its own vocabulary for dealing with it. And so sometimes, some of the puzzle forms one is familiar with. Like in my case, I'm familiar with some of them, but some are. It's like I'm a student, and I'm just interested in how you're coming at it, what your puzzle forms are. And so when I mentioned forces, I was just taking a kind of a gross global concept that is bandied around from the beginning of modern physics, and trying to use that as a basis for defining some alternative uses of forces. And that helps me solve my puzzle form. And same with steerer and steered. But that jars somebody else's puzzle form because it has a connotation. Somebody mentioned, some of these problems are problems of language. And I guess in almost any area, you could say Wittgenstein or something might say that, it's the language, it's the vocabulary we're using which helps shape the conclusions we come to, and change the vocabulary and you're apt to come to a different set, is certainly a different set of questions and a different set of research problems. And so we've got a variety of research problems underway here, clearly, from the responses. People are doing very interesting research in a variety of different areas, and it's hard to find an archetypal vocabulary that covers all of them. I mean, Vasilios and I was fascinated with his concept of the way he's defined the commons. And it just raises a whole set of questions, and it raises answers and questions. And one of the questions was, we were talking about yesterday when, I'll stop here, but he mentioned those commons in Switzerland and so on. And the first response, that the people in my end of the world, the neoliberals, if everybody's gonna agree to the same box, fitting in the same box and doing so in a humanitarian way, what about invention, new inventions, and the person who wants to get out of the box, and because the answer for the economists today is, well, the system we have is rich in new discoveries, and just the internet age is an example of people who have created new perspectives and changed the world in new. So can we live in a commons and agree to the rules if we're not allowed to break the rules, which is a way of saying create a new perspective, and Basilius has some interesting, I think, responses to that. But,
I think we probably don't have time for the responses, so that will have to be done later. But let me take this opportunity of thanking you both very much indeed for what I see as absolutely classical network talks. Stimulating, beautifully put, clear, logical and really mind expanding. What I like about it is the fact that they appeal to everybody who's of different disciplines, so they weren't really limited in one area. And the questions themselves have brought up interesting points. Nice to see Gurdjieff raising his mind, being raised here. And the idea of higher mind and the idea that the moment of perception is the moment of creation, and this was a subtext which was really going on throughout it. And then the whole question of the influence of culture and what culture did and how it was, in fact, modifying the actual system that gave birth to it as well, and therefore was feeding right back into the universe. And so that automatically brought up the whole question of steerer and steered, which we haven't yet resolved, but many of us, I think, would probably see that that is harking back to old dualistic thinking. And in fact, maybe we have got things wrong in that sense. So I'm sorry that we have to end, because it's been such a wonderful morning. So can I ask you all to thank both Basilius and Lawrence for stimulating.